debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, it's the Tom Hartmann Podcast, brought to you by Cameron Hughes Wine. There's a little secret that most people don't know about the highest quality wineries in the United States and how they work. They'll say, you know, as they start their year, okay, we're going to bottle, say, 5,000 bottles of wine this year. And so they overproduce for that, produce enough for maybe 6,000 bottles of wine. But, you know, they've sold 5,000, they're ready to get 5,000 out. And so that's basically all they do under their own label. And then when they're done, they've got casks of wine left over that haven't been bottled. Cameron Hughes contracts with some of the very best vineyards in America to take that essentially surplus wine. I mean, you know, it's the exact same wine you would buy in a bottle for 50, 60, 100. One of the Cameron Hughes wines I had last week, the retail price, if you knew who the brand was over $150 a bottle. Cameron Hughes buys that in bulk, bottles it, puts just a simple number. Here it is, lot 506 or lot 622. Simple number on it, and you get some of the most spectacular wines at huge discounts off what you would normally pay. Cameron Hughes has been doing this since 2001, seeking out high-end wine from around the world and selling it online direct to his customers. This is not just American wines, earning Cameron Hughes Wine the number one wine brand online. It's just extraordinary stuff. I recently sampled lot 609. This is a Cabernet Sauvignon. It was insane. It was so good. It was bold. It was rich. It had the black fruit and red licorice and crushed red rock, all these extraordinary tastes, juicy and ripe on the palate. You got to check this out. Go to chwine.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. C-H as in Cameron Hughes, that's his name, the guy who started the company and runs it. I've talked with him. He's a great guy, and he's doing amazing stuff. chwine.com/T-H-O-M. Or text the word wine, W-I-N-E, text the word wine to 511-511, and you'll get free shipping with your minimum three-bottle order. So text wine to 511-511, Cameron Hughes Wine. Exceptional value, extraordinary wine. Now enjoy the podcast.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's Monday. Let's start out the week with Congressman Ro Khanna taking your calls for the hour. There's so much going on. I'm sure that Congressman Khanna has a lot on his mind. I do on mine. And if you'd like to present him with your questions about what's going on, our telephone number 202-808-9925. Congressman Khanna represents the 17th District of California. He is the I believe you're the What's your title with the Congressional Progressive Caucus? It's vice chair?
Vice chair.
Vice chair. Thank you very much. The vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And you can tweet him at Rep. Ro, R-O, Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A, and his website, khanna.house.gov. Congressman, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, boy, there's a lot going on. I understand, A, you've got a jobs bill for all coming up in Congress. B, the Medicare for All caucus. This is a big deal. I'm seeing stuff that indicates that the number one issue across America, regardless of party, is health care and concerns about the expense of health care. And that's a big deal. And I'm curious your thoughts on the president's tweets this morning.
Absolutely. Well, look, on the Medicare for All, this is the most momentum we've had in Congress on this issue for ever, really. We've had 70 members nearly sign up for Medicare for All. And the idea is that this is, as you know, pro-jobs, and it's going to save costs. I mean, one of the things that infuriates me, I was doing a interview on Fox News this weekend, and they said, well, do you realize Medicare for All is going to cost $32 trillion? And I said, well, that number doesn't mean anything unless you compare it to our current system, which costs $49 trillion. So actually, you would save $17 trillion, which makes sense, because you would get rid of the private insurance costs. You would get rid of the costs that pharmaceuticals are charging. You would get rid of the hospital fees. And of course, this is everyone in the caucus believes you should have health care from the day you're born. You shouldn't have it contingent of filling out forms or fighting with a bureaucrat. So I am very optimistic. Pramila and Mark Pocan have done a terrific job starting the caucus. We had a great press conference with a lot of enthusiasm. And I really am hoping that this eventually becomes part of the standard Democratic platform, not just the progressive platform.
Cool. And your Jobs for All bill, tell me about that.
Jobs for All is a very simple point, which is that we need to help people in places of large unemployment get a job. This calls for a subsidy of a person's wage, as well as a subsidy for them to get a credential. You have a program like this in Germany. Basically, the government helps pay the wage for an individual to get a job as a teacher in the government, for a small business, and it gets them an opportunity to work with a good wage. One of the things that when you talk about the 3.8% unemployment rate or the stock market growth that just gets lost in the discussion is most people have not had in wages, and their costs are going up, and people don't have good jobs. And this program makes sure that people will have the opportunity for a good job, and it also is something that will make sure we deal with the geographic inequality and geographic divide. There's certain places that still have 8, 9, 10% unemployment.
Great. And finally, and then we'll pick up your calls for you, if that's all right with you, is I'm curious your thoughts on Donald Trump's tweets this morning in all caps threatening the president of Iran. It seems like, I mean, Rouhani is the reformer, and it seems like by going all hard right on him, what Trump is doing is emboldening, on the one hand, the hard right forces in Iran, which is not broadly a good thing for us, and also the diminishing the power of the moderates who are trying to bring Iran into the 21st century.
Well, putting aside the juvenile nature and the dangerous of threatening war on Twitter, which was said that this administration is marching us towards confrontation with Iran. And I've been more concerned about getting into a war with Iran than even the situation in North Korea. I mean, they came in, they undermined the Iran deal. They have strengthened an alliance with Saudi Arabia. They have admitted that they are sending a part of the troops' mission even in Syria. The special operation forces are to contain Iran. Tillerson had said that. So you have Pompeo and Bolton. In Bolton's case, someone who's been itching for a confrontation with Iran for the past 20 years. And they're setting this up to draw us into another war, which is why I have said, and Barbara Lee and others, that the Democrats right now need to be very, very clear, that we need to be unified, and every Democrat should be absolutely clear that we will not support any invasion or hostilities or strike into Iran, so that we're not divided the way the Democratic Party was divided when they rushed us into war in Iraq.
Yeah. Okay, let's pick up some phone calls here. David in Columbus, Ohio. David, thanks for listening. You're on the air with Congressman Ro Khanna.
Hi, Congressman. Since California leads the nation, I think either single-payer health care or free college education would be a good demonstration project for California. And that was going to happen, but then it got sidetracked somehow. Can you explain what happened?
Well, I agree with you that it would be a good program nationally, and certainly in California. Pat Brown, our governor, built the state based on a funding of the UC, University of California system, and the California state system to provide affordable education. And now that's no longer the case. I mean, the UCs cost $20,000-$30,000 a year, and even California state universities cost about $10,000 a year. The funding is the issue in California. We right now are, unfortunately, there's an initiative to repeal the gas tax, which would deprive the state. I oppose that, but it's an issue that would starve us from revenue. People have been unwilling to raise the taxes on the top earners, and they've been unwilling to revise Prop 13 that restricts any taxation on property, including commercial property, that we would need for as a source of revenue to do things like free public college. So it's an issue of values in California legislature being willing to raise the revenue.
Yeah. Congressman, just FYI, I'm guessing you're talking to us on a cell phone because every other sentence or so we miss two or three words. They're dropping out. I don't know
I'm
if there's...
That I'm on a landline.
Oh, you are?
I am. But let me move to a different room.
Maybe it's a VoIP landline or something like that. Whatever it is. Anyway, I just thought I'd give you a heads up if you can improve the signal. Okay, Mark in Albany, New York. Listen on Sirius XM. You're on the air with Congressman Ro Khanna.
Congressman Ro Khanna and Tom, how are you this morning? My question is very simple. A lot of us smoke screen about what the president is doing takes away from other issues, too, that the Republicans are trying to do. I just heard a recent report that they're going to try to do some more gutting of Medicare and Medicaid. Have you heard anything about, plans by the Republican right to really go after Medicare and Medicaid before this next election?
I don't think they're – I do know they want to go after Medicare and Medicaid. I don't think they're going to do it before the election. What I do think they're going to do is further tax cuts. I think in the fall they're going to – try to make this awful tax package they passed permanent. And they're talking about a further reduction in the capital gains tax rate. And we have to be prepared to fight them on that issue. What they're, they accuse us always of wealth redistribution, but what their tax plan is doing is taking money from hardworking individuals and really redistributing it by having hedge fund owners and private equity owners pay a reduced tax rate by reducing capital gains further and not charging ordinary income. So that's really been their agenda.
Yeah, and it's remarkable. Congressman Ro Khanna taking your calls for the hour, 202-808-9925. We'll be back with more of your calls for Congressman Khanna right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a brand new week, and Congressman Ro Khanna is answering your questions on the air. Stick around. Welcome back. Congressman Ro Khanna is on the line taking your calls for the hour. Congressman, you're still with us?
I am.
Okay. Alan in Northwest Indiana, you are on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Congressman, my name is Alan. We have a high rate of unemployment, as you said, in our inner cities with primarily young men, for decades. What have you done to instill training programs, and what will you propose to instill training programs in the future? Thank you. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, I, first of all, completely agree with you. We have very, very high unemployment in some of the inner cities. We also have, by the way, very, very high unemployment in rural areas. Some of the highest unemployment areas are in states that Trump carried. I've proposed two things. Now, Congress needs to pass it, but I have said that we need to provide subsidized employment with benefits to people to get them a start, to get them into the job market. they can be doing productive work. They could be doing things to help clean up our environment. For example, I read this recent article this weekend about people who were going and planting sea algae in the ocean to help reduce carbon. You can be doing a tremendous amount of public good and jobs in that area that we need. They could be doing things in the private sector, the child care, or in technology or elder care. But we have to give them a start by having some subsidy on their wages and support services to get them into the job market. And Stephanie Kelton has written about this, Derek Hamilton. It's a matter of the political will that we need a president and a majority in Congress to pass it.
Tim in Hendersonville, North Carolina, you're on the air with Congressman Ricana. And you need to turn your TV down.
Hello.
Hey, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I enjoy your show very much. I listen to it as often as possible. I think there's two things I'd like to mention. One, I think the Democrats, who have been brutally dismantled in the marketing departments by being labeled as debt or as a redistributing wealth, they should brand themselves and say, no, we're going to redistribute the debt. And if you look at the way debt is created and who holds on to the notes and who holds on to the debt in this country, I think that that's a real important thing. So, you know, look, we're not going to redistribute the wealth. We're going to redistribute the debt and make it so that the disparate have a better chance to take part in not owning the debt.
Okay. Your thoughts, Congressman?
Well, I think you're right that a lot of the debt is owned by hardworking folks. But I think what this wealth redistribution is the biggest farce of a Republican description of Democrats, because the people who are redistributing the wealth are Republicans and their tax policy. They're explicitly taking money from hardworking Americans who are having to pay ordinary income tax and redistributing it to stockholders and investors who are getting huge tax breaks for either outsourcing or for having lower capital gains or carried interest rates. The entire tax plan is redistributing wealth from hardworking Americans to the investor class. I think what the Democrats need to say is we are restoring the basic belief in this country that you ought to make what you deserve, and that we're going to be giving people a raise because the money has been sucked up out of the working class and middle class to the investor class.
Ivan in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Ivan, you're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hey, good morning, Congressman. Yes.
Good morning.
I'm calling about the donut hole. Can you explain briefly how it works and what could be done to fill it other than Medicare for All, which, of course, would be a beautiful thing?
Well, the donut hole, as I understand it, is that there is an amount where you're covered for prescription drugs and others. Then there is an amount after you cross a certain threshold where you're not covered, and then again, you become covered if you have something catastrophic. But what this means is if you have a chronic illness or you really need medicine for cholesterol or for diabetes or for asthma, then many people have to end up paying a lot out of pocket. Obviously, there are things we can do to fix it. Congress just needs to fund more the coverage of prescription drugs and allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drugs so that they would bring the cost down. But I think ultimately a Medicare for All is the type of comprehensive solution that this country needs.
Tyrone in Harlem, New York, here on the air with Congressman Khanna.
How are you doing, Tom? How are you doing, Congressman?
Good.
I was wondering what could be done to stop this archaic backwards law that I feel is racially motivated, that stand your ground law. You know, even back in the Wild West, if you shot an unarmed man, it was against the law. You have to go to jail for it. We have gone back so far back that the law even defines what was going on in the lawless Wild Wild West. If this law spreads, all it's going to do is bring our country back to the time when you could just indiscriminately kill someone and say you were afraid, and that's justification.
Congressman?
Well, I definitely think we need to relook at some of these laws that have led to too much of tolerance for killing, and that it needs to be a very, very high standard. I mean, I would have to look state by state, but I don't think that we ought to give people allowance to kill
unless there is just absolutely extraordinary circumstances. And in many of these laws, they probably are too permissive, just like our laws with police using lethal force need to be stricter. In my state, in California, there's a bill that may redefine the standard and really say that it can only be used if absolutely necessary. So I do think all of our laws, whether they're civilians or police, the use of lethal force should be heavily restricted.
What's the bill in California?
I don't remember the number, but they're relooking at the standard for what the use of force is, and they would make it a much stricter standard for the use of force. And so it's going right now through the California Assembly. The ACLU is behind it, and I think it would be it would restrict basically police from a deadly force. The standard would be one that would be much, much harder. It would say where it's necessary to prevent serious bodily injury. And it's not just when there's reasonable cause, but would specifically say it's a necessity for preventing bodily injury or death.
Fascinating stuff. Speaking of California, Rob in San Diego, you're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Congressman and Tom, you know, one of the big benefits of Medicare for All that nobody talks about is what a huge relief of a burden it would be for employers not to have to have, not to be shopping for insurance. I mean, administering open enrollments, et cetera. Not only that, the lower costs of Medicare for All will help make every employer more competitive around the world.
Thank you for making that point. You're absolutely correct, and I'll tell you, representing Silicon Valley, I hear this all the time from companies and startups. There are two points to it. The stagnation of wages of employees is directly tied to the increase in healthcare costs. If you had taken the same money that companies right now are having to pay in healthcare premiums, and if they had put that money instead to employees, you wouldn't have the stagnation of wages that we've had in the middle class. And secondly, to your point, one of the biggest things that restricts people from moving from job to job or changing jobs is that their healthcare is tied to their employment. And if we change that, it would make things much more competitive. It would allow employees much more flexibility to leave, which would actually increase wages. So I really appreciate how you're framing this, because I think the progressives, we should not hesitate to point out the competitive and pro-growth advantages of Medicare for All.
Jordan in Durham, North Carolina, you're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, Congressman, how you doing?
Good.
Congressman, I have one question. I'm a young African-American young man, and I've been struggling with Social Security, and I just want your comments about that and jobs.
What do you mean by I've been struggling with, Jordan? Do you mean...
Like I've been struggling to get in college and, you know...
I appreciate that, and I would say two things. One, obviously there is still systematic racism and challenges, particularly, I mean, I'm Indian American, but I think when you're African American, there's no community that has faced more the brunt of racism and discrimination in this country. And so being clear-eyed that those challenges still exist. But I thought, actually, President Barack Obama was extraordinarily eloquent when he would go and speak to young African Americans, and he would say, these are the challenges. No, don't think that they don't exist. But you still have agency. You still can dream. You still can overcome those and be confident to try to do your part, because generations before have done theirs. And so I'm serving in the Congress with John Lewis, who was beaten literally on the Edmund Pettus Bridge so that African Americans could vote. So I think just keep working to do your part and to make this a more just society.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Congressman Ro Khanna right after this. Welcome back. Congressman Ro Khanna taking your calls for the hour. Janelle in Port St. Lucie, Florida. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman. I'm calling because I want to know if anything's being done about medical marijuana. I am currently on it. I had a serious auto accident that caused me severe nerve damage, and I've been on all kinds of medications, and different levels of opiates as far as that was concerned. Last November, I started medical marijuana. In November, I was able to come off the opiates 100%. Now, the problem is that doctor that I go to is a licensed MD, but I cannot put her office visit through Medicare or Medicaid, Medicare or my insurance company. Also, medical marijuana is extremely expensive, and that's another charge that I cannot put through Medicare or through my insurance company for coverage. And I was wondering what's being done about helping people out like me.
Great question. Ma'am, I really appreciate your sharing your story. If you have the time and can call my office today or tomorrow, I would be willing to share this story. I would love to highlight it because Barbara Lee and myself and Cory Booker have a bill to legalize marijuana in this country, to not make it a Schedule I drug. As you point out, it would actually help with the opioid crisis. It would help economically. There are a lot of medical benefits, and we need citizens like you to be able to share their stories. So I really appreciate it. There is legislation in Congress on this, and we need to just continue to get support for it.
Michael in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Congressman Connor.
Yes, I was calling to find out what the congressman's position was in support of cannabis legalization. The lady preceding me took care of that issue, obviously. Moving forward, I'm wondering what is it that the majority of the Democratic committee representing all 50 states can do to come online and share the same perspective of legalization and be outspoken within their candidacies in their local primaries, et cetera. In California recently, one Democratic person stated in opposition to the in favor of legalization from a RNC member that they didn't want to legalize. I mean, it seems like a disconnect within the DNC party. Your thoughts, please?
Well, I think there are three very good arguments for legalization. One is it's economically a smart thing to do. It's going to create huge industries and jobs, too. It actually can help avert some of the opioid crisis. It's much better and safer to use medical marijuana and use marijuana for things that people are using worse drugs or more addictive drugs for. And finally, there's a racial disparity angle to it. I mean, the if you're bluntly young and white and you try marijuana, you're probably not going to have your life ruined. If you're a young African-American or Latino-American, and particularly in the inner cities or urban areas, and you do that, you may have your life ruined and a criminal record. So there, it's a racial justice issue as well. And I think particularly with young voters, it's a major issue, and it should be something that every Democrat supports.
I'd add a fourth one to that. That is that it breaks the back of organized crime. We saw this with the when we ended alcohol prohibition in the 30s, and it put John Dillinger's contemporaries all out of business.
That's a great point.
Yeah. In fact, I think that's one of the major motivators for you know, like what Portugal did. Pat in Seattle. Hey, Pat, you're on the air with Congressman Connor.
Hi, Congressman Connor. This is really a comment about the universal health care. I've been married 60 years. I'm widowed. But I tolerated 60 years of physical and verbal abuse, and I could not leave my husband because I needed the insurance. I had underlying medical problems, and his employment, I could get the insurance from him. I could not leave him because I would be unable to get it without... Well, on the open market.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your story, and I can't imagine how difficult that was. But this is why we need to make it very clear. You should have health care in this country the day you are born or the day that you become American. I mean, that is just should be a basic right of living in a civilized nation so that you don't have to worry about conditions of how you get health care in making life choices.
Deanna in Redding, California. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Oh, hello, Congressman Khanna. I just wanted to make a point that if we have Medicare for all in this country and only if 200 million people pay $100 a month, like people on Medicare and Medicaid do now, or Medicare do now, how much money are you bringing in every month? And I think that would more than cover the health care coverage in this country you know, and you can take out the all of the insurance, and you can take out a lot of the medical overcosts or overheads that doctors' offices and hospitals have to pay. And, yeah, it would put a few people out of jobs, but they could be retrained in jobs that would really help people instead of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies.
You're absolutely right, and that's you're explaining in very simple and thoughtful terms that how you get that $32 trillion for Medicare for All versus the current health care, which is $49 trillion, and how you save $17 trillion because you are taking out a lot of the costs, as you point out. Now, one of the things people say is, well, you're going to have to pay some tax or $100 a month or $200 a month, and what they omit is, yeah, but right now people are paying nearly $1,000 off in a month or $600 a month to their private insurance companies, and that cost won't be there. So almost every American who chooses this option would save money.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We have just 15 seconds here, Congressman. What should we be looking at this coming week here?
Well, I think we're going to continue the appropriations fights. I mean, remarkably, the Republicans still are not funding things for election safety or election integrity. They're continuing to gut the EPA and different agencies, and so we're going to be fighting hard for that. And then we're still really fighting for these kids to be united. It was just done in such callous disregard that you still have kids separated from their parents, and there hasn't been a significant effort, enough effort, in my opinion, to reunite them. And so many of us are going to continue to push for that this week.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
Hey, do you brush with an electric toothbrush, or have you wanted to? If you're using one of the older, bigger, bulkier, you know, and some of them, you know, are so aggressive they can even damage your mouth, electric toothbrushes, or if you've never used an electric toothbrush, I want you to pay attention. There's a new electric toothbrush. Time magazine called it the invention of the year, right? It's called Quip, Q-U-I-P. It's slim, it's lightweight, it's about the size of a regular toothbrush. It's got a little AAA battery inside that powers it for months at a time between changes. And it does a really great job. It aggressively cleans your teeth, but it does so in a way that's good for your gums and good for your teeth. It's the perfect two-minute clean. So check this thing out. And it's great for traveling. It comes with a little tube that you can drop it into travel because, like I said, it's about the size of a regular toothbrush, much, much smaller than your big electric toothbrushes. And you can find out all about it at getquip.com/Tom. That's G-E-T, getquip, Q-U-I-P, .com/THOM. Getquip.com/Tom for more information. It's only $25, and they send you the refills, the brush heads that you're supposed to replace every 3 months. Every 3 months, they'll send those to you for only $5 free shipping. It's an amazing deal. Getquip.com/Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is political analyst, historian, and journalist Thomas Frank, founder of The Baffler magazine, author of numerous books, including What's the Matter with Kansas's latest book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. His website, tcfrank.com, and you can tweet him at Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, welcome back to the program.
Mr. Tom Hartman.
How are you?
I'm glad to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. Back at you. Rendezvous with Oblivion. This is serious stuff we're talking about here.
Well, you say it's serious stuff? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
but done with a certain amount of humor. Yeah, so it's a play on Franklin Roosevelt's phrase when he said this generation is a rendezvous with destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to tell you, Tom. I'm very unhappy with the state of life in the United States, and it's not just about Donald Trump. So the book is a collection of essays going back about 10 years in which I document it's mainly about the sort of the intellectual guardians of the public interest and how they have failed. This is something that my eyes were open to during the financial crisis and that I started caring about and really paying attention to in the years that followed. And they're just across the board failure. and, you know, yielding us the world that we live in today. So Trump is kind of the culmination of the book, not the beginning of the critique. The weird thing, Tom, is I go back over essays that I've written over the years, and you've read many of them. You read many of them when they came out. Mm-hmm. But I basically forgot about those essays as soon as I wrote them, and as soon as they were published, I just forgot about them. And then I went back and was looking at them, and everything pointed to Trump. It was just the weirdest thing in the world.
Wow. It has occurred to me, and in fact, actually, my book that Hachette poorly titled The Crash of 2016, starts with the Powell memo in 1971 as the turning point when the hard right reached out to the business community and kind of then they integrated themselves into each other. And, you know, then Powell got put on the Supreme Court, and then you got the Buckley decision in 76. Paul was put on the Supreme Court in 72, and maybe 73, whatever. And boom, you know, that leads right to Citizens United, and then you got, you know, billionaire oligarch running Fox News Network, Rupert Murdoch standing up for billionaire oligarch Donald Trump, and all these guys who helped fund, you know, like, you know, the Heritage Foundation and others saying things like, you know, we don't want people to vote, you know, the famous quote from what's his name. So, you know, yes. And it seems like the high water mark was Reagan's election when he could actually put this stuff into law, and nobody has reversed it. We're still living in Reagan's world. What do you think of that analysis?
That's right. Well, you got to have a second political party if you want to do that.
How so?
I mean, you have to have a party that opposes.
Oh, well, this is your book, Listen Liberal.
If you want to reverse it. I'm sorry, I'm so cynical, I'm like the Hobbesian.
No, I get it, but this is your book, Listen Liberal, you know, which you and I talked about on this program.
Yeah, I know it. It's so frustrating. Everything you just said is exactly true, and I remember when this stuff was happening in the 1980s, and it was shocking to me at the time, and I could see very plainly at the time in the 1980s where this was going if you allowed it to continue, and that is it's going straight back to the 19th century.
Yeah.
And that is really where we are. And can I tell you something? And by the way, so Rendezvous with Oblivion documents all of these sort of different facets of the change that you're describing that you would never really think of. So there's several essays about the higher learning in the United States, like the corporatization of the university, which is a really sinister story once you start looking into what's happened to higher learning in this country. And there's essays about architecture, about the McMansion. I do this one about the history. I'm very fond of this one, an essay about the history of the McMansion. I go to various presidential libraries, et cetera, et cetera. But the question that I have been thinking about a lot lately and that I don't have an answer for, Tom, but that your monologue a minute ago got me thinking about again is this: how does a society recover from an age of corruption?
Well, that was that was the essence of my book, Crash. And it's that, you know, basically we've done this three times, and every time we did it, it followed a major economic disaster, which was then followed by a war. And the Great Crash of 1770 led to the American Revolution of 1776. The Great Crash of 1856 led to the Civil War of 1861. The Great Crash of 1929 led to you know, the New Deal.
Sure.
Right. And I think that it's going to take another Great Crash. What do you think?
But we had it. We had it.
We didn't, though.
That's the thing.
I mean, if that crash had happened 2 years into Bush's presidency instead of just 6 months before the end of it, it would have attached itself to him. And as it was, you know, Obama got us out of it and the Democrats got us out of it, but I don't think Americans realized how bad it was.
You're exactly right that they didn't realize. I mean, people were furious, and if you ask me, are still furious. So for people today, that is the foundational moment to a certain degree. That is the nightmare knowledge that lurks in the back of everyone's mind when they're, you know, because it did expose the professional class as being, you know, profoundly corrupt. The Wall Street guys, the home, the real estate appraisers, you know, et cetera, the people that rate bonds. Everybody was on the take. Everybody was in on it. And then they all got bailed out. And that's the sort of nightmare knowledge that's behind everything that has come since.
And apropos,
by the way, but
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead. It's your show.
Right. Well, yeah, but it's about your book. You know, in Listen Liberal, you made the point that the Republican Party represents the 1%, and the Democratic Party, as reinvented by the Clintons and the whole DLC thing back in the 90s, represents the top 10%. Nobody's representing the bottom 90%. And I think that's what you were referring to when you said, you know, if you're going to push back on Reaganism, you need a new political party. But I see that emerging inside the Democratic Party, from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Bernie Sanders to, I mean, to even, you know, so-called corporate Democrats now singing the tune. I mean, you've got now this new caucus, Medicare for All caucus, that just emerged.
Yeah, I know, it's great, isn't it?
I mean, good stuff is happening, it seems to me.
Those are really positive developments that you just described. Those are all, like, really great things. What's sad is that, and I keep coming back to this point because I'm fairly obsessed with it, but I think historically, that's just how my brain works. We thought we had that in 08. Mm-hmm. We thought that's what we were choosing with Barack Obama. And we thought, or at least I thought, and I thought he was the right man for the job, for the occasion.
I thought that's what we had in 92.
Go back and read,
you know, my book Threshold.
Well,
Clinton's entire New Covenant speech. I mean, he campaigned as FDR in 92.
I know. But he didn't have the financial crisis. I thought that was the turning point, and I thought that Obama would have to rise to the occasion. And instead we got what we got, you know, and half measures in all things, and Republican Party bounced right back. You know, this must be the most incredible thing. You and I were talking about it at the time, the Tea Party movement. Look at what they're doing.
Yeah.
You better get out there, Democrats. And because they are so allergic to populist outcry, they are so, you know, they want nothing to do with that kind of discontent. They're very uncomfortable around it. It doesn't come naturally to them anymore. And the rest is history, as they say. I mean, they left that up to the Tea Party movement and to Donald Trump to sort of fake.
Yeah, it really seems to me though that all of this is changing. We're talking with Thomas Frank is changing. We're talking with Thomas Frank, his new book "Rendezvous with the Bolivian" reports from a sinking society. Thomas, we have just a minute until we're going to hit a hard break here, and we got to bail on this. Your thoughts on where we're going?
There's hopeful signs in the rising left wing of the Democratic Party. Very hopeful. On the other hand, I don't think Trump is going to be as big a pushover as people think. I think that there is something going on in this country, and I think mainstream Democrats don't get it. And I think it's a really, really ugly turn. When Trump and Bannon talk about making the Republican Party into a workers' party, they're not kidding. That really is the plan. And it's something that, you know, it's basically it grows out of everything that you and I have been saying in our conversations over the years. It's entirely predictable that they would try to do this. Now, the Democrats, you know, this is the moment. They have to stop these guys.
Yeah.
Well, let's see them do it.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep agitating if you will. Thomas Frank, his new book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, reports from a sinking society. Thomas, thanks for dropping by today.
Oh, no problem, Tom. I love it.
Thanks. Always great talking with you. Yeah, the website, tcfrank.com. You can tweet him at Thomas Frank. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls in just a moment. And welcome back. Pat in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind today? Pat?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Pat. What's up?
I have been wondering for a long time why the Democrats don't organize around the mission of climate change. You can do the jobs issue, the equality issue, the cultural issues between men and women. People need a mission, and we can make industries sustainable and have the right industries helping out the planet. Mm. What do you think?
I don't disagree with you, Pat. I think, though, that broadly we need to figure out exactly how to message this. Up until now, the messaging has been basically scientific. If we continue down this road, if we continue with climate change as it's going, it's going to lead to massive cultural, economic, and human disasters. And disasters for basically all life on the planet. I mean, we're looking at something that could be that bad. And so, you know, we've got to do something about it. I think that that's actually starting to sink in. You're now getting a few Republicans who are talking about climate change in defiance of the Koch brothers. You know, and people are starting to realize that it's, you know, people like ExxonMobil and Koch Industries, you know, that make their money with fossil fuels that, of course, are going to be funding climate denying science and things. But I think the big thing that's happening right now that is going to help us is that you're getting, you know, cities. My brother was visiting from Michigan over the weekend, and I grew up in, you know, he and I and my other two brothers, we grew up in Michigan. Throughout my childhood, you know, for all the years that I lived in Michigan, from 1951 to 1978, I have no recollection of a day, of any day, that went over 100 degrees. I mean, it just, you know, in Lansing, Michigan, it probably did once or twice, but it was so rare. You know, you think three-digit, you know, temperatures, that's Phoenix, Arizona. You know, that's southern Texas. And now it's happening all over the country, and it's really hitting farmers, and it's really freaking out, you know, people. It's gonna have a big impact on food prices here soon, and I think that it's reaching the point where it's unescapable. And so maybe we can just continue the economic or the climate disaster discussion, because frankly, that's the purest discussion around this. You're right, though. You know, empowering local people by solarizing their homes. You know, Hawaii is running those ads now, the Hawaiian Power Company. We're going to have, you know, all solar power in Hawaii or all renewable power in Hawaii. These are things that could be done. I think these are all good arguments that we can and should be making, Pat.
Right. And the Democrats have not educated the public about it much as they could have.
They try really hard, Pat. It's just that the media, the corporate media in America will not put, and we've had several Democratic politicians on this program complaining about this out loud on the air, will not put Democrats on the air unless they're willing to talk about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I know that.
Or Russia.
But you know. I think the recognition is worldwide. Yeah. And it can have so many positive benefits that the Democrats are just not talking about. They get lost in the details.
Yeah.
And the science, you're right, isn't gonna persuade people.
Well, I think it may start to, and I think the fact that it's getting so damn hot out there is really starting to cause people to go, huh? Really? So we'll see where it goes. Pat, thanks for the call. We just, you know, need to keep up the messaging. We'll be right back. You know, in the world of work, one of the most important things is one of the things that people probably think the least about until they have to sit in it, which is their chair. And the X chair is absolutely extraordinary. This is the new high-tech. In fact, they've got a brand new version. It's called the X3, the newest version of the X chair. It is comfortable. It is high-tech. And yes, I'll say it, it is sexy. This chair is extraordinary. And it will dramatically, consequentially improve your concentration and productivity because it's going to help your posture. And, you know, if you're not in pain and your blood is working, you know, flowing well, your brain is going to work well. The new X3 is quite simply the most modern, ergonomic, high-tech, comfortable office chair in the world, period. The X3's unique ATR fabric makes it feel like you're literally floating on air. And its patented split-back lumbar technology provides a cradling, customized feel that has to be experienced to believe. You need to see and feel the X3 for yourself. Go to xchairtom.com. That's xchairtom.com now to check out the X3's perfect blend of design and ergonomics. A lot of people, you know, checking these out and going for these chairs. Supplies are limited, so don't wait. Order at xchairtom.com. And if you do it now, you get $100 off. That's xchairtom.com. Or you can call them at 1-844-4-X-CHAIR. This chair comes with a 30-day, no-questions-asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. That's how good it is. Go to xchairtom.com. Right now, use the code TOM, T-H-O-M, to get a free footrest. xchairtom.com. Now back to the podcast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Professor Jason Stanley. He is the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, the author of four books, including his latest, which is due out on 9/11. It's titled How Fascism, which is what an appropriate date for this book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And it'd help if I click the right button here. Professor Stanley, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for being with us. Your book is extraordinary. I read the first chapter, The Mythic Past, for one of our book reports to share with our listeners. Just, you know, in fact, it was just the first couple pages of it. It's really, you've nailed it here. Can we just go through this?
Yes.
So how does fascism start? First of all, how does it work? You call it the politics of us and them. Can you give us a working definition for fascism here?
Well, my book does that with 10, I talk about 10 different properties of fascist politics. But basically, fascism is ultra-nationalist, patriarchal, authoritarian, against public goods of any kind, and forges an us-them distinction using ultra-nationalism and fear of the other, based on their lack of participation in the national community, however you define that.
How is that different from the Tea Party phenomena that was funded by a small group of cranky right-wing billionaires?
Well, the Tea Party phenomenon has strong affiliations with fascism. I would say that the difference would be insofar as libertarians are very careful not to make group generalizations and just say we're about, if they just say we are about individual liberty and don't broaden that to say, for instance, that, you know, whites are under threat from non-whites, then they avoid fascism, because fascism makes the leap from libertarian, from a certain kind of libertarianism, like life is a struggle, it's all about hard work and who wins, it's all about winners and losers.
Meritocracies.
Yes. To, it makes a struggle, it makes a move from that to saying that certain groups are winners and other groups are losers. And, you know, I would say that a consistent Tea Party person who wants to avoid being a classical fascist should avoid making generalizations based on group identities. They should avoid patriarchy. They should avoid demanding a return to tradition, to certain national traditions that marginalize other national traditions. So the Tea Party itself was a sort of inconsistent tent. And I think, you know, insofar as it's possible, I'd like to bring in some of those members, both committed religious conservatives who would be against some of the hate directed against immigrant groups, as well as libertarians who are committed to rejecting group generalizations like.
Yeah. So let's just go through these. You start out with the mythic past. Tell me about this.
So all fascist movements talk about a mythic past. They talk about, in every fascist movement, for instance, India today, the Hinduvatu movement says back in India's glorious past, it was a pure Hindu nationalism, and we must return the country to that. It's always patriarchal. You're making the country great again. And the thing you have with like Mussolini and Hitler and Alfred Rosenberg, some of the National Socialist ideologists, is they were very explicit that the past was mythic, that the past that they were glorifying never existed. And the idea is to create a sense of nostalgia for a past country that never was, to make the country great again. So there are certain sort of general features of the mythic past. It's always patriarchal. It's always pure. It's always like a certain group, the traditions of a certain group reign supreme. You know, you could say Christmas without hurting anyone's feelings because Christmas was the dominant tradition, as it were. In Hungary, Viktor Orban talks about, you know, returning Hungary to making Hungary great again. So this is a dominant theme of fascism. The idea is to connect, to give people a sense of yearning for a country that never was.
Wow. And then you offer to reprovide that. What about propaganda and anti-intellectualism?
So here's a core example. Every fascist campaign is an anti-corruption campaign. Even though the fascist candidates or fascist parties are often manifestly much more corrupt than their opposition, because democracy is represented as corruption. Because in a democracy, what do? In a democracy, you've got to make lots of concessions. And so you've got to make concessions to different groups. Fascist leaders represent that as corruption.
So a fascist candidate would use phrases like drain the swamp.
Mussolini did.
Yeah, okay.
That's point made.
I
mean, Madeleine Albright makes that. Both Mussolini and the Nazi Party ran anti-corruption campaigns promising to drain the swamp. And, of course, our current president, whose business practices were manifestly quite, let's say, dubious, managed to run an anti-corruption campaign.
Yeah.
So by propaganda, I mean, as in George Orwell, you know, war is peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anti-corruption is used in the service of corruption.
Tell me about victimhood.
So victimhood is what I mean in the chapter on victimhood is in fascist politics always appeals to the traditionally dominant group and tells them they are the real victims,
even though they're in charge.
Even though they're in charge, and it paints, and of course, many of the people in the dominant group are victims of, say, capitalism, for example, or like, you know, of certain brutal,
like white men are seeing their wages go down.
Exactly, but they're made to feel victims, not of that, but they're made to feel as cultural victims. So their attention is directed away against what's actually victimizing them. And towards a kind of cultural victimhood.
So it's a message. It would be like a message to white men that says that your wages are not going down because that's what capitalism does. Your wages are going down because women are coming into the workforce and people of color are coming into the workforce and all those Mexicans flooded across the border.
And also, you know, your cultural traditions are being disrespected. Hitler in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf talks about my time in Vienna, talks about the theater and the decadent theater and how it wasn't representing true German art. So how, you know, the theater, the media is attacked for degenerating the tradition, the cultural traditions of the dominant group.
Yeah. Nixon and Spiro Agnew ran on a platform of law and order. And I see law and order as one of the characteristics of the emergence in your book of a fascist takeover. Was Nixon moving in that direction, or was he just using a catchphrase that worked well for him? And how do you see that happening in contemporary America?
Nixon has a lot of elements of a fascist leader. I'm careful in the book to say you have these 10 properties, and it's a sliding scale. Okay. So Nixon certainly didn't have all. But this is a very powerful way to come to power, is exploiting these mechanisms of fear. And there is no question that Nixon used demagoguery about black Americans. We know from Elizabeth Hinton's work, a recent 2016 book on mass incarceration. Nixon said to Haldeman, the problem is the blacks, and the goal is to construct a system that recognizes that while concealing that.
Right.
That it's doing that.
Right, so, with the drug laws.
Yes, the drug laws.
Yeah.
And he said, we're going to go after marijuana to get the hippies and heroin to get the blacks.
Right. So
law and order, what law and order means there is that the out-group is always, by their nature, a violation of law and order.
Mm-hmm. So walking while black becomes a crime.
Or tellingly, Jeff Sessions said about Donald Trump, you can tell from Mr. Trump's reaction to the Central Park 5 case that he's going to be a law and order president. Now, Mr. Trump, in his reaction to the Central Park 5 case, was to say that perfectly innocent teenagers should still be punished.
Executed, so, in fact.
So what sense of law and order is meant there? It's certainly not democratic law and order.
Yeah. Your last chapter is Arbeit macht frei, which is the slogan that was over one of the concentration camps. I think it's Dachau.
Auschwitz is over several different
Auschwitz, okay. And it literally means work makes you free. At the same time, Matt Blevins, the new Republican governor of Kentucky, is now trying to associate work rules, work requirements with Medicaid, in other words, basic health care for poor people, women, children in the state of Kentucky, theoretically to knock, as many as 100,000 people off the rolls to save the state money. But does this tie into a fascist agenda as well?
Absolutely. It's a key element. Hitler decries welfare in Mein Kampf as destroying the economic independence of the nation. But the point there is, at the core of fascism is social Darwinism. Life is a struggle. It should be hard. In fascist leaders try to say, in struggle, you find meaning. And so you want to make life as hard as possible. But especially the idea is you want to make life hard for groups that have been supposedly leeching off the state. Under the National Socialists, this was Jews. Jews were using the state to get interest from hardworking Germans via banking. And so Jews were supposed to supposedly lazy. And the idea was they needed to be made to work. In that chapter, I talk about how across the world, the out-group is always represented as lazy.
Remarkable. Remarkable stuff. Professor Jason Stanley, a new book, it'll be out on 9/11. You can pre-order it now. How Fascism Works, the Politics of Us and Them. It's absolutely brilliant. Professor Stanley, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Great talking with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Ernest in Corvallis, New Mexico. Hey, Ernest, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I have a friend that moved here from Arizona, and when he lived in Arizona, his father had a cattle ranch up in the mountains, and he was a Republican. So what he did was he would have barbecues to raise money for Republicans. And my friend was about 17 or 18 at that time, and he says he became a Democrat because he got tired listening to those people like Barry Goldwater and his cohorts describe how they were going to steal this and steal that when they got into power. And so he became a Democrat.
Remarkable.
One more thing.
Mm-hmm.
I also read a book about New Mexico. It's called The Santa Fe Ring.
Mm-hmm.
And these were people that in the 1840s, 1848, 49, after New Mexico became part of the United States,
right.
There was this group of politicians and lawyers and stuff like that, and they would scheme on how they were going to steal the land from the people, the Hispanic people in New Mexico. And guess what? They were all Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, Ryan Zinke just got busted for this. The Washington Post has an article, in fact, it was breaking news about 3 hours ago, about how there was an accidental dump of a whole bunch of emails from Ryan Zinke's office, you know, the Secretary of the Interior, about how they were going to completely ignore how Americans loved their national parks, how Americans use, what percentage of Americans use the national parks, how the national parks generate revenue, how the, you know, all the benefits and values of national parks. They were going to delete all that, and they did, by the way. Delete all that information from the public comments that they were going to put out as they were cutting up our national monuments and our public parks and turning them over to their oil, you know, and billionaire buddies. So this is nothing new, Ernest, but it's a great point.
No, it's not. I just thought it might be interesting. The anecdotes might seem interesting to somebody.
You're right, and they were. Thank you. And it was a great stepping off point to talk about what Ryan Zinke is up to. Curtis in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Curtis, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, listen, I really respect your opinion. And I was wondering, I was just looking at Russia's economy over the last 10 years, and from what I'm looking at, it seems like the sanctions got their economy down to about the size of metropolitan New York. And I don't understand, with such a small economy, how can they compare with the kind of money we're spending on the military and our large economy as far as being a world power? That's the first question.
Let me answer the first question first, okay? Number one, they have about the same number of nuclear weapons we do, and that's the parity that ultimately matters for the Earth. The entire Russian defense budget is about the same size as the increase in our defense budget that Donald Trump asked for in the last budget. Militarily they're not our equal. But in terms of nuclear war, they certainly are, and that gets them a lot. Back to you.
Okay, the other thing is I have a little small, really big website that only targets the United States citizens, and I block out all countries outside of the United States. Why we can't block out the .ru domains and cut this crap out if it's such a problem?
You're talking about the trolls on Facebook and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, any traffic that's coming from Russia, why we can't just block it out?
You're right. You can do, you know, domain specific deletes, although probably then they would just VPN into a different country and come from there. But I think that this is an issue. These are the kind of things where you want, and Curtis, thank you for the call, where you want to have a president who is actually in dialogue with the president of another country. You want Donald Trump to be talking to Vladimir Putin to work out stuff like this. Unfortunately, you know, Trump just can't do it right. I mean, this is the big problem I see, is that Donald Trump doesn't know, he's incompetent. And so he's like, oh, I'll go over there, we'll talk about this in private, and we'll get all this straight. No. You have your people work the details out. You come up with a punch list of things that you want to accomplish. You identify your goals before you go into it. I guarantee you that's what Putin did, and it's apparently not at all what Trump did, tragically. Jonathan in Daytona Beach. Jonathan, we have 1 minute left. What's up?
How you doing, sir? I was calling because maybe you can help me with this, but I'm trying to figure out what has the Democratic Party done for Black Americans.
How about passing the Voting Rights Act? As a starting point.
See, I feel like we're still stuck in 1964, and that's my biggest issue. I feel like the Democratic Party wants Black Americans to stay stuck in 1964 when everyone else comes over to this country and reap the benefits of the blood, sweat.
Have you looked at the racial profile of the Republican caucus, Jonathan? I mean, I'm assuming that you're not a Republican troll trying to just troll me here.
No, I'm not.
But the Republicans have got like what, one Black guy in all of Congress? You know, Tim.
I'm not a Republican. I'm a Black American.
No, I get that. But you know, what have the Democrats done for me? Come on, it's the party of inclusion. It's the party that is saying, we're here for all Americans, not just the white supremacists. That seems to me like a hell of a good starting point. Thanks so much for being with us today. What an amazing day, an amazing news day. We will continue our conversation tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. We can't just sit on our hands. We've got to get out there. We've got to show up in tidal wave proportions this November. The voter suppression is full tilt boogie. They've already knocked over 10 million people off the voting rolls in the last 10 years. Get out there, get active, get registered, get your friends, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.